Hello and welcome everyone. I'm Mabel Jang, the host of 51%, a podcast series presented by Multicoin Capital. This show is exploration of blockchain's rapid development across Asia, with a particular focus on perspectives, communities, and operators based in China. My goal is to bring Eastern perspective to West and Western perspective to East, so we can better understand the crypto's unique market structure and how these distinct communities think and operate. This podcast will feature a mix of English and Chinese discussions. The language you're hearing now will be the language I use for the rest of the podcast. Stay up to date with my latest episode by subscribing to this podcast. Thank you for listening.
Mabel Jang is a principal at Multicoin Capital. All opinions expressed by Mabel or other podcast guests are solely their opinion and do not represent the opinions of Multicoin Capital in any way. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as an inducement to make an investment or relied upon as investment advice. Multicoin Capital may at times hold positions in some of the tokens or companies discussed on this show.
Hello everyone, welcome back to 51%. I'm your host, Mabel Jang. Today I'm excited to host the co-founder and project lead of Sal Ventures, Felix Sien, to be on our podcast. Hello, Felix.
Hey, Mabel.
How are you?
Great. Good to be here. Thank you for inviting me to this podcast. Finally, I can contribute to the content rather than just appreciate all the content that you've been sharing so far.
No problem. I guess before we jump into discussion, let's talk about your background. How did you get into crypto?
I got into crypto quite late, actually, compared to many of my friends and the people around me. I literally just got into crypto when I was introduced to Deribit, which obviously allows all of us to trade options on BTC or ETH. And that was one of the first major things that I did to get into crypto, as they say. Obviously one thing led to another. And from there, I then explored more about the ecosystem and about the other projects that's going on, and came across this thing called Play to Earn, which at that time wasn't that popular, actually, but I found that very intriguing and decided to dig more.
Got it. I didn't know you trade options. That's new to me. What were you doing before that, though? Meaning, like, your career?
I started my sort of professional career in a corporate bank doing FX sales trading in Singapore. And then I moved on and joined a hedge fund also based in Singapore. And I was doing everything over the years, from back office to middle office to risk management to analyst work, to like all sorts, like client relations. And then when they moved me to the fund of funds team, then I started doing a lot of quant and qualitative analysis on the other funds. So I've always had an interest in trading. I just never felt that it was supposed to be a career move for me. And then I moved to Dubai in 2008 and lived there for 4 years. I worked in the DIFC, the Dubai International Financial Center. And I was doing a lot of regulatory work there. So in simple terms, I helped financial institutions set up in the DIFC and helped them work them through the process of getting regulated by the authority there. So did that for 4 years before I came back to Singapore in 2012 and, of all things, decided to start an events company. So the only question that I know I will not have an answer for in this podcast is, why did I start an events company? Don't know why I did that. yeah, but we did it. And then it's specifically the events that I used to run in the team, a corporate event. So we did a lot of team building, family day festivals, gala dinners. So it's all corporate events and all people, employee engagement stuff. Met my wife along the way. She quit her job and joined that business, and she's obviously been running it since. So since then, I think it's almost just over a decade now. The business is still doing pretty okay. And I'm just looking at the numbers the other day, and I realized that we've run over 2,000 events. And over the last decade, I think at least 1 million people have attended the events. So that sort of got me very, very interested in human capital, in the way people work, in the way people are rewarded. And you know that along with what I came across in the Play to Earn space last year, got me really, really motivated to start a project in this space.
That's super interesting. So I probably introduced you to Chris before, Chris Gonzalez from Community Gaming. Before he started Community Gaming, he was also running, it was not full-time, but he was also running kind of tournaments and events offline for gamers across New England and in the United States. I definitely see a kind of a path leading towards Play to Earn at organizing guilds and stuff, like, you know, coming from that event organizing space. So I thought that was a very interesting coincidence.
Yeah. I think Chris is doing an amazing job at community gaming, and I think the parallel that you draw is very real. It's you know, I think a lot of us, as a lot of founders actually, not just in the crypto space, but a lot of founders tend to use sort of past experiences to try and build something better, bigger, and that's what I really enjoy about the crypto space. I like to say we get to use Web3 resources to build Web2 businesses, and I think all of us should actually be doing that.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard to really divide like what's Web2 and Web3 these days. Like these gags are used like overly. It's actually hard for me to kind of like claim something it's Web2, because at the end it's all business. But the way to organize the business, the form of it, sometimes it changes because the incentivization layer changes. So now this leads to my question, what is Sala Ventures? And obviously your mission and vision.
Yeah, I think the answer to that question somehow just subtly changes over time as we build. I still remember when you and I first met last year, Sala Ventures was nothing more than just a play to earn guild, right? And then we were doing so many things internally, like the scripts that we wrote, that we used for our own guild, the training that we were running on Zoom, 6-day live Zoom training program. We're doing all of that internally, but at that time, Sala Ventures literally was just a guild. So obviously after we met and like so many times and discussed through what Salad was actually doing and what we could potentially achieve, then I was inspired by you actually to make it into something a lot more institutionalized, a lot bigger, so that more people can be impacted by what we're building. So I'd say Salad really is just it's a brand, it's a family of products that we will be building eventually, and what hasn't changed is me and my team, we really believe that especially COVID, when it first hit all our shores 2-3 years ago, I think COVID has changed the way people work, and I believe that there needs to be In this new way of work, there needs to be new rules. There's got to be new infrastructure, new software, new processes, and new education. So our mission really is to be able to contribute to these pillars, and hopefully, you know, we're able to set a few good examples along the way, and encourage more people to come into this space and focus on building on this.
Right. So you mentioned now Salad is a suite of products. What are these pillars?
Yeah. So in the last few months, we've been building a lot of products, but the three that have already been launched are the first is our guild. So we rebranded the guild. It's no longer called Cell Adventures for obvious reason. So the guild is now called Apollo Squad. So Apollo Squad is our guild of scholars. So we've got scholars playing a different game, so including Axie Infinity and Pagaxi, which is what most other guilds also have scholars playing, and that continues to run, that continues to grow, but our focus primarily are on the R&D two other pillars, the two other products. One of which is Guild OS. So Guild OS is a web-based dashboard tool that allows anybody to start, manage, and scale a guild in any blockchain game that we integrate with. So at the moment, Guild OS already integrates with Axie Infinity, of course, as well as Pagaxi. The third product is Salad Academy. So Salad Academy is the Udemy for GameFi, how it works. What it does is it teaches anybody who wants to learn how to play a game, a blockchain game properly, to do so by going through different modules and then taking a quiz. And at the end of the quiz, if they pass it, they then get to mint a free NFT certificate.
Great. Understood. So let's start with your initial experience running the guild. How did you think about positioning yourself to differentiate from the other guild service provider, or not service provider, but like other guilds generally in the space? Because at that time when you came out, I think there were already some competitors.
Yeah, at that time there were already quite a few guilds. Because obviously we're not the first, but I saw that there were a few things that a few processes that I would have done differently if I ran a guild, the way we differentiated ourselves was primarily through our process. For example, in the past and even today, many guilds were trying to find scholars on social platforms like Twitter. And the way they would do it is they would post on Twitter and they would say, just like and retweet this post and follow our account. And then by the end of the day, we'll pick, 10 people to give scholarship accounts to. I think that that was a very, very strange way of bringing scholars into a guild, especially during those days. It was very expensive. The capital expenditure for each account was very high. And I found it strange because I don't think, if Multicoin was hiring for an analyst, you wouldn't go to your Twitter and say, just like and retweet the guys, and then by the end of the day, I'll send someone to Kyle, right? Like, that would never, ever happen in the real world. I thought it was really strange. Why was it happening in a guild world? Of course, you can say that it's more risky to hire the wrong analyst for a venture capital fund rather than hiring a wrong scholar. But everything is relative, right? The impact, if you keep hiring wrong scholars or keep bringing on wrong scholars to your guild, is going to be very, very big. So that was one thing that we changed immediately when we first started. And the way we did it was we literally posted on job boards online, those online job boards, and wrote proper JDs and told them exactly who we are and what we need them to do and how much we're going to pay. The theory behind that was that, scholars are, in my opinion, sort of playing these play-to-earn games for guilds, because to them it's an income source. In other words, it's sort of like a job. It's like an online job, really. So if it were an online job, then shouldn't we hire and interview them properly as if we were hiring and interviewing somebody locally? So that was what's going through my head. That's why our source for scholars were not, like people on Twitter or actual gamers. We were targeting people who were looking for jobs online, and that worked out very well because those group of people were very, very serious in delivering what they promised us. So that's just step one. And then there are so many different steps, right? Like, for example, how we interviewed them differently. Our form, our application form requires the scholar to complete a personality test as well as an IQ test. And there is a certain hurdle that we need them to overcome in our test before we even consider their application. And then after if they get through the application stage, we then put them through a six-day live Zoom training program. That was before we launched Salad Academy. So that was done very, very manually, but it was sort of like a webinar style on Zoom. And we tracked them very, very carefully. We tracked the performance very carefully as well. So I think in a nutshell, we were a lot more pedantic about our processes. We were very, very careful with regard to who we gave a scholarship account to. And then after we onboarded a scholar, we were also very hardworking in managing, training and tracking the scholars. And I still remember at that time, somebody told me that we were one of the most difficult guilds in the world to get a scholarship from and the easiest to lose a scholarship, which is quite true. Because, you know, if they don't meet the mark after a warning or two, then we just let them go. You know, because there's always somebody else out there who also deserves this opportunity, but is willing to put in more work.
Yeah, I remember when we first chatted, one thing you mentioned actually left a deep impression, because at that time I've encountered many other guilds. Many were trying to impress people with the number of talents they have, but rather you mentioned like you win without, not because like you have the largest number of people or laborer, but rather it's the quality, the ROI. And I think the deep insights about how to manage people, how to better utilize all the capital, the human capital, so to speak, was very interesting. So then it really inspired me to suggest the idea of becoming a management system.
Yeah, it's also very cultural, right? Because as you know, my team, my core team and I, we're all Singaporean and we're all based here. Most of us have lived here for our entire lives, and the culture in Singapore, as you are obviously familiar with, is we're a very small country, and I have never seen a factory with 10,000 people working in it in my life. Yeah, so I would never know how to manage a guild of 10,000 scholars, for example. 10,000 being an arbitrary number, but you know, it's a very big number. But what we have seen and what we have grown up with in our life is we've seen small offices with, you know, 10 people doing the work of 200 people, or 50 people doing the work of 10,000 people. And the way that has worked in Singapore for the last 50, 60 years is the policymakers have constantly been investing in infrastructure and education because we just don't have the numbers here. And I think that has rubbed off on me a lot. And I thought, you know, what's the point of, I mean, if you really wanted to create social impact, I believe that you need to do it through education firstly, and then you need to do it through by providing some kind of infrastructure. I think that is the way that you can scale social impact, as opposed to just, you know, trying to recruit 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 scholars and then just handing them, let's say, like a Pegasi account, right, or something like that. That's it's what they say. Like in the last podcast that I was on with DeFi Vader, instead of giving a man a fish, right, it's the tip, it's the cliche, teach a man how to fish and pass him tools and let him do it. I think that is more impactful to the space.
Absolutely. During the introduction of how this whole process works when you run the guild, you mentioned the course that you give people, the six-day course. Can you maybe elaborate on the process of a course at Salad Academy? How does that look like? And then how do you pick which games you give courses for?
Yeah, so Salad Academy, so if your listeners go to salad.academy, they'll see the site. We've actually upgraded the infrastructure as well, so it's now running on a new platform, which is very good. And the way it works, I'll explain that first, is anybody can just go to salad.academy to sign up for a free account. They will then pick from our list of courses to take, and courses are differentiated by different games, and for some games there are more than one course because it might be a little bit more difficult to play or difficult to maximize earnings. So then in that case we would create multiple courses for the same game, and after they have picked the game then or the course, they'll then be presented with a list of modules. Let's say there are 8 modules. It comes with slides. It comes with a training video recorded by my co-founder, Wesley. And the student would just literally go through each and every module. At the end of the let's say 8 modules, they will be presented with a quiz. They then have to complete that quiz. It all happens on Salad Academy. They complete that quiz, and if they pass, I believe we've adjusted the passing rate to slightly lower. I think it's 70% now. It used to be 80 or 90%. So I just told him not to be too Singaporean and to be a bit more forgiving. So they lowered the pass rate. They get 70% of the questions right. They then get certified by Salad Academy. And the way certification works is the platform first whitelists them, whitelists their email address that they use to register their account with. This list of whitelisted emails are then sent to our partner, which is obviously another multi-coin portfolio project, Project Galaxy. We work very, very closely with the guys at Galaxy. This list is then sent to their team. Their team then sends out an email there to invite the student to go to their site to mint a free NFT certificate. Thanks to the team at Project Galaxy, they've sort of completely taken away the need for us to, you know, even have to hire anybody in-house to just to create this NFT minting technology. So we integrate very well with them. And the student then gets to go to the Galaxy site and mint their free NFT. And these NFTs are all custom designed in-house by our team at Salad. And they're non-transferable, non-tradable. So it literally just sits on their MetaMask account that they use to mint. And they would then use that to show to either our managers at Apollo Squad, which is our guild, or to some other guilds as they apply for a scholarship there. So that's sort of how the entire process works. With regard to how we pick and choose games to sort of launch on the academy, it's the first criteria is always it's got to have a working game, because the academy is a bit more like a launch pad for games that already work, that are already live. It is not a shilling, it's not a shill pad. So the game needs to be at least on the testnet. We prefer it to be a mainnet, but otherwise testnet would also work. And we'll then go through we'll have multiple meetings with the team. So my content team and led by Wesley would then go on to have a few calls with their content team, with their game team, basically go through the ins and outs of their game. How do you get started? What wallet do you need? How do you fund it? Where do you get testnet tokens if it's on testnet and so forth? So it is very, very tutorial based to make sure that we don't miss out on anything. And if anybody takes that course, they will know exactly how to get started in that game. And then part two will be, how do you best play this game? And how do you get a higher score, for example, therefore make the most money? So we've had many, many games, and we constantly have games coming to us wanting to launch certificates on Salad Academy. But the problem there is that, as you may also know, most of these games have spent more time on their white paper than the actual game itself. So if there's no game, there's nothing we can do to launch on the academy. So that's the biggest criteria. And then the next criteria that we look at before we decide to launch a game on Cell Academy is we do a lot of qualitative due diligence on the team. So we look at who's backing them. We ask around our own cap table, our own community of investors. Obviously, we ask you as well. And then, you know, if we get a good feeling that this is not a not a rug pull or not a potential rug pull, or these guys are actually serious about what they're doing, then we spend a lot of our time and resources to launch the certificates for them on Cell Academy.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned this like very old, simple concept, even cliche concept of giving people, teach them how to fish. So how do you think about Cell Academy and GuildOS, the relationship between them, and then the potential, I guess, growth loop look like?
It's super connected, these two products. In fact, the three pillars or three products that we have right now, the Apollo Squad, GuildOS, and Salad Academy, are very, very much interconnected. In the XYZ to earn space, or in the Work 3.0, as I like to coin it, you still need to have sort of like you need to have a labor force. You need to have a group of people willing to do work for money, obviously. So that is, to us, that is Apollo Squad. Apollo Squad is our organized labor force. And then, you know, we need to then show them and teach them and train them what to do. And that would be what we do at Salad Academy. And for GuildOS, after we send them off to get work done, whatever work eventually is, we need to be able to manage that labor force. We need to be able to track their performance. We need to be able to pay them. we need to be able to move people around, move assets around. So that's what GuildOS does. The way we see this work is once we open up GuildOS to other guilds, which we intend to do so this year, the growth loop would be a lot more obvious. At this stage, if you think about the stakeholders that are in the Salad ecosystem, they are, of course, the game studios, the guilds, as well as the gamers, the players themselves, the scholars. And the way it works is, we're putting a lot of time and resources behind building Salad Academy and getting more game partnerships to launch certificates for on the academy. So we start with the games because they need help to explain the gameplay. They need help to sort of westernize many of the explanation that they have, because many of these games are built in Asia or Southeast Asia mostly. So they'll come to us and they'll say they want to, they need help. They've seen our past content, they've seen our past certificates, that's sort of how we start the relationship. So we start with the game first, these games, of course, would have already got other guild partnerships, and some other informal guilds, right? So, a group of friends, or just one guy with, 20, 30 accounts, and then he wants to start a guild, but he doesn't call himself anything. But these games obviously already have the community that contains these people. The guild owners or the guild managers. We work with the games to introduce GuildOS to these managers, because we'd say, look, we're going to integrate this game into GuildOS as well, which means it is easier for this manager to create a scholarship specifically for this game. In other words, think about it. If there were two games, and let's say they were both tower defense style games, right? So let's say gameplay is very similar, tokenomics and all that are very, very similar as well. But one game is integrated into Guild OS, which means if you wanted to create a guild around this game, you could literally just come onto Guild OS, pick the game, and tell us how many accounts you want, and all that will be created for you. You fund those wallets, we'll find the we'll pull the scholars in, the certified scholars in from Salad Academy, and fill up your guild in, let's say, 30 minutes. Versus another game that is not integrated into the Salad ecosystem, what you would then have to do is you'd have to go onto Twitter and write a post which goes along the lines of, like and reshare my post, guys, and by the end of the day, I'm going to give you 10 random scholarships, right? And then if you find those 10, you then have to reach out to them one at a time. You have to do an interview. You have to train them. You have to make sure that they're not going to steal your NFTs or rug your account or something. You then have to go and create 10 different wallets and 10 different accounts. You have to fund all of them manually. If you're working with a wallet like Ronin, you cannot even import or create multiple accounts in the extension. You literally got to delete the extension and reinstall it. So imagine doing that 10 times, right? And then sending out these accounts to these scholars, and then on a daily basis, logging onto these accounts, tracking their performance, and then making sure that they are hitting the targets that you set. Then just to make things more realistic, the next day, one of them's not going to turn up for work. And you wouldn't even know. So by the end of day two, you would have had an opportunity cost, right, of one account not being played by a scholar because he just decided not to play that day. So then you go through the whole process of firing the guy and then going back onto Twitter and then, you know, again, all over again. So and then now you're saying, oh, this is great. I'm doing this work. And as a guild manager, I'm probably making about, let's say, $50 a day, right? So that's $1,500 a month, let's say, earnings that this guild manager can get. And then he divides it by the number of hours that he actually spends per day managing this group of 10 people. So now he's better off actually going to drive for Uber, Grab, or working at McDonald's, right? Then become a guild manager. All of that it's super, super time consuming. And then it just, at the end of the day, it doesn't make sense to run a guild anymore. I think in the past, we talked about what the guild managers actually care about the most. What do they actually want? I think, you know, everyone starts a venture for different reasons, but from what I see, most guild managers that I've observed at arm's length are in it for the money, which is not wrong because that's what capitalism is about, right? It's about really about making money, and okay, if they create value along the way, it's good. But they start guilds to make money, and I think. One problem that I see a lot of these new guild managers are not have not considered properly is they just look at the quantum. They just say, yeah, I've got 1,000 scholars, so I'm making, like, I don't know, $15,000 a month or something, and it's great. But if they literally divide it by the number of hours that they spend to manage a guild of 1,000 scholars without a technology like GuildOS, then based on an hourly basis, it is no longer worth it. So I think that's a huge problem that we will be able to solve once we open GuildOS to the other managers. And it doesn't matter whether you know they're a manager with 5 scholars or 50 or 500 scholars. It makes no difference to GuildOS. We'll be able to help them manage it and therefore make more profits at the end of the day while creating a bigger impact. Players, on the other hand, I think want to clearly just, you know, want to make money. They need a job, and it's a really easy job, you know, to play a game, regardless of what game it is, play a game and get paid. And most of these players don't depend on their scholarship as the only source of income. So it's a supplementary source of income that lets them buy the next iPhone or shop at Zara or something, or buy some, right, gifts for their family. So I think with this, with what we're building here at Salad, It helps to improve the entire ecosystem. It makes everything more efficient. And I actually believe that it makes everybody more money if they follow a proper process. It's more efficient.
Right. Super fascinating. I think you touched upon a lot of interesting things that I wanted to comment on. I think the first thing was that Apollo Squad, it's really the power user of your own protocol. Well, I guess I call Salad Academy and GuildOS a protocol, but it's not the strict defining protocol as like the Web3 protocol, but more like a standard that you're creating, a framework that allow everyone else to use. But Apollo Squad is the first power user for that. And I think that approach actually allows you to improve GuildOS and Sal Academy before going out to the world and that everyone else use. So I thought that was very interesting. So I definitely see the kind of point that, you know, having the management tool, having the education toolkits, but then, you know, at the same time, you also have your own kind of, it's almost like an experimental organization for yourself to try out whether some approach works or not. So I thought that was very interesting. The other thing you talk about, I guess like the other thing that inspired me was that Sal Academy and GuildOS essentially kind of becomes this discoverability tool for the games. So like in addition to the games itself being very fun and having like very good PR or whatever, like being on top of this, like can also give them a lot more exposure to the other guild managers and whatnot. So I thought that's also super interesting. However, I do have a question for here though, because think about all of these like great games that you're integrating. I'm sure everyone else also know about it. I mean, there is a chance that sure, like someone decided to, you decided to integrate someone and then like nobody else knows about it, but this chance is relatively small. So how about the guild managers who want to, I guess, be the discoverer of a new game that has the high potential in the future, but it's not existing yet on Salad or GuildOS? Like I'm sure you have thought about this.
So is the question how can they approach us? How can they find us?
Not find it, but more like, let's say I want to use GuildOS as my like SaaS to manage my guild for a game that you do not integrate or you do not have the course for.
Right. Okay. It would just take a bit of time to integrate, but it's not going to be that complicated anymore in the future. I mean, the most complicated game that we've integrated, so right now we've integrated with two games in the last few months of development, Axie and Pagaxi. For both of these games, I believe will be the most difficult games to integrate with because we don't know the teams there. We've got no special treatment from them. We're literally just using whatever tools that's available. We are setting up our own nodes to get the data from their chain or from their respective chains. So it's very manual still to set up at that time. But I think moving forward, especially if a game, for example, if a guild was already playing a game, they would most probably already know the team at the game, so all they need to do is make an introduction, and we will similarly to the team at Project Galaxy, we'll also be building our own APIs for GuildOS. So we'll have an API/SDK that will then allow games to integrate with GuildOS very easily. So the plan is to sort of flip it around and saying, look, instead of us writing every single line of code and trying to integrate every new game that we come across or that's been introduced to us, we'll write the API, we'll come up with the SDK and send that to the games instead, and let games integrate to GuildOS rather than for us to sort of go out and actively write code to integrate every different game. So we'll be creating the standard with regard to how games, if they want to integrate into our software what they need to do. So that's what we're planning to do to be able to scale the integration process.
I see. So you're doing pretty much like a do things don't scale kind of model right now. Mm-hmm. Like start with the more manual approach and then later on open up and become a standard. I see. That's interesting. You touch upon the like what the players want and then what the guild manager wants. I guess the interesting thing is like for all of these, it's similar to how the guild managers, they have a lot of choices, like they can choose whatever games they can. And then same for the players, they can also go in whatever guilds and say, hop around and say, I like this one, so I'm going to stay. Or like, I don't like this guild, I'm just going to try out here and then like leave. How do you see, like, you know, from your observation, because like you also previously managed guild before, from your perspective, how does the player really think, or like their psychology look like when they're choosing the guilds in addition to financial turnouts? Because I'm sure the financial turnout is also very, very important. But given that there are so many guilds, I'm sure a lot of guilds can offer them the same amount of money. So what else are they thinking?
Yeah, so the thought process behind a player before they go out and when they are going out to find a scholarship is they apply for every single guild that they can find. That is smart, and that is something that they do. Now the problem there then becomes attrition, right? Like what do players want in order to continue staying in a guild? And I found that a lot of these scholars actually want a sense of community. They want a sense of fellowship with their peers, whether it is with other scholars in the same guild or with their guild managers. So they're always looking for this kind of affirmation that, you know, they are wanted. They feel that they are important. It's very emotional, you know what? Because like you rightfully pointed out, there's so many guilds out there, and you know, it's obviously one day it's gonna be there is going to be some kind of equilibrium where if it's Axie Infinity, this is how much you get paid. If it's Pagaxi, this is how much you get paid. If it's Happy Land, this is how much you get paid, for example. So I don't think pay or salary or price is the point. I think the main factor that scholars are looking for over and above getting paid on time is a sense of community. That is for sure something that all of them are looking for.
Interesting. So I guess like it's the same for every single organization that involves human. I think the sense of ownership and loyalty is always plays a very important role. Now let's talk about GuildOS a little bit more. What are the functions as of today that you're thinking to offer from GuildOS? And if you were to manage a guild today, I guess that you are, what are some of the more sophisticated functions on your wish list to build, to be included in a guild management tool?
So the current version of GuildOS is called GuildOS Core, which literally means the main things that the main modules that are required in order to save at least 100 to 200 hours a week off the hands of a manager or a team of managers to manage a guild. So right now we have definitely every single scholar management feature that you need. So you could create scholars, obviously edit them, put in the details, change the account. Scholars can log in as well to check their performance and check their payroll pay slips, which is the second module, which is payroll. So in payroll, our module allows us to be very, very flexible in how we pay. So for example, we'll say in the game of Axie Infinity, we would pay them, let's say, 50% of the earnings. In this case, SLP, we'll pay them 50% of SLP every week if they hit a certain baseline, for example. And these are sort of rules that we can already set in GuildOS. And we'll also say at the end of the month, if they earn, let's say, 10,000 SLPs, then we'll pay them an additional 2,000 SLP, for example. Payroll also allows us to make salary payments on a periodic basis. So we can do that daily, we can do that weekly or monthly, anytime, or ad hoc as well. So the manager can log into GuildOS and they would say, so for scholars group 1 to 5, I want to pay them today. And the manager could log in and just literally click on the groups of scholars that they want to pay and hit pay. payments we have also done. So you could pay them in the in-game utility token. So let's say again, for simplicity's sake, we use Axie. So in Axie, if you want to pay your scholars in SLP to their Ronin address, you can choose to do so. If you decide to pay half of them in SLP and the other half in XRP, for instance, we have also integrated. We have also integrated with the FTX API. You just need to create a sub account in your guild's FTX account, put in the API key for that specific sub wallet, and we'll be able to send out payments from that account to your scholars as well. And then the most important yet the most boring thing or action in running a play to earn guild is the claiming of the in-game token. So SLP and let's say Viz from Pagaxi allows you to claim every 14 days or so. I think most games are sort of using a very similar model. So, you know, with 10 scholars, and if you claim everything on the same day, it's fine. You claim it on the, let's say, the 10th of every month, or every 10 days, you literally log in to claim every account. But you still have to do it 10 times, right? So log in, claim, log out, log in again, claim, log out, do that 10 times, 50 times, 100 times, depending on how many scholars you have. And you got to do that every, let's say, 14 days for Axie. The feature that we have in GuildOS is it's a background process. So what this background process does is every day it goes through all your scholars' wallets. And if there is any wallet that is claimable today, it would just simply make the claim. So it would withdraw the SLP from the scholars account into the scholars game account into the scholars game wallet, or it would withdraw the Viz from again the Pegasi account into an ETH wallet. So that is done every day in the back, so you don't have to see it. So literally every morning when you get up as the manager, you would pull up your guild's, let's say, treasury account, treasury wallet, and just see how much money you've earned overnight. That's already claimed back to the wallet. So those are the 4 or 5 features that has saved our HR team of 3 people at least 100 hours a week already. And then, of course, that's the tracking part of what we do. I tend to downplay the tracking of the performance of our scholars in GuildOS, because there's so many people who says, oh, there are just so many scholarship management tools out there. What's the difference between GuildOS and all the other scholarship management tools out there? And I like to ask just one very simple litmus test question. And that question is, do those tools require you as the user to provide private keys of your scholar accounts, of your guild treasury accounts for that game? Does that tool require you to provide private keys before they allow you to use it? And 100% of the answer is no. So the next question that I have is that if they don't have the private keys to your scholar accounts, then how can they manage it? Right. So in other words, many of the tools that's been promoted out there that says that they are a P2E guild management tool, it's not really a tool. Most of them are just glorified dashboards. They look really great, but they're literally just pulling from the game APIs and displaying data in a more beautiful way. That's really what it is. There is no management. You cannot via the tool, claim your SLPs or claim your VIFs. You cannot pay your scholars directly on that page on that tool. They normally say, oh, they've got another script on GitHub that lets you do that, but you've got to download Node.js, you've got to do it on your computer because we don't want to take your private keys and blah, blah, blah. So to me, I think that is already a huge, huge difference. And that explains why, like you rightfully pointed out, we still continue to run a guild because we are eating our own dog food. If the code doesn't work, if GuildOS gets hacked, I think we have the most to lose. We'll lose everything if that happens. So we take all that very, very, very seriously here at Salad.
That's super interesting. I like how you think very deeply about like what's considered management versus not. I think at this stage, we are still at the phase where there are a lot more guilds coming out. Maybe there's some differentiation. We are already seeing some verticalization of guilds, like not all. Like now we are already past the phase where everyone just go into Axie Infinity and say like we have some differentiation, but it's all on Axie Infinity. Today we are already seeing that. But still, like the level of management that we are seeing is not yet there. So I'm very looking forward to the next phase for sure. I have a very fundamental question here to ask you about all of these play to earn. I'm sure a lot of people who are from the traditional space also are very confused. So this trend of pay first to play, it's something. Seems to becoming more and more mainstream versus I think what people are used to are free to play. It's completely different kind of mentality or ideology. Do you think free to play is still going to be more dominant later on? Or do you think this is a paradigm shift that like our industry is going through and then it's going to just stay here in this way? I'm curious your take here. I know this is very controversial. There's no right or wrong answer.
Thanks for that disclaimer, because there is no right or wrong answer, because we only know when we're dead, right? I mean, it's a long, long, long shift, I think. It's like, I don't know, I get, it's like asking me if anybody would be reading books on the internet 20 years ago, right? I think both models will coexist for a few very basic reasons. One is in the play to earn space today, there are no games that are both profitable and fun at the same time. They are either fun to play or they are profitable and therefore not so fun to play. The reason is because it takes time, right, to build a good project. And games are like, they're difficult to build. They're really difficult to build. It's not easy. There's a lot of planning that has to go behind it. So it's hard. So I think that both models will coexist for many, many more years. And they will attract different types of players to them. Not everybody wants to play games for money, right? Even if you gave them money, they may not even want to play the game. If only it were that easy to start a game studio and make it successful. It doesn't work that way. So I don't think the lure of making money is a strong one. I think games still have to focus on not the play to earn aspect, but the actual game itself. I think games need to be addictive. People tend to say that I've heard other guilds, say that this game is the art is really nice, and then the gameplay looks really fun and all that, and then they ape in, right? And then they create a Medium post and they ape in with 100k, 200k, and I'm like thinking these guys are crazy. Like the game's not even live. You don't even know what it feels like to play, and and you're aping in. But there are still investors like that, and I'm sure there are going to be players like that as well. But if you ask me, What I think, what the advice that I give to studios, because as you can imagine, we're talking to games every other day now, multiple times a day sometimes. And the advice or the questions that I start with and the advice that I eventually give is, I think the game studio needs to decide on whether they want to make their game fun to play or profitable to play, because right now they can't have both. There's just not enough time. And in order to make it fun to play, they have to focus on designing some form of addiction to that game. For example, for a period of time, I was addicted to Mini Royale, which is a first-person shooter, like Counter-Strike, Clash of Duty kind of game online, right? By Far Away on the Solana chain. But I mean, you can't earn from the game. I mean, I've not played for a while now, but I literally was playing that game in between my fundraise calls, right? So in between calls with investors, I was just playing that game. I'm just trying to keep myself awake, right? It's so boring to be saying the same thing over and over again to so many different people. But anyway, that's past now. Yeah, but I was addicted to that game. It's very, very low poly, which means, you know, the graphics not amazing, but it's like Counter-Strike. I love playing first-person shooter games, and it was fun and it was addictive. So I kept playing it without being paid, right? So I think game studios need to design addictive games, not just fun games or games that look nice. It's got to be addictive so people keep going back. And then at the same time, I think games should also stop, especially blockchain games, well, blockchain games in particular, they should absolutely stop talking about tokenomics. Whenever they try and sort of design the game, I think they should talk more about the game economy as opposed to the token economy, because I think that if they keep focusing on just the token economy or the tokenomics of their game project, it would either fail at launch or it would die a slow death, because I think they've put their focus on the wrong thing. Imagine if they design a nice game economy, a proper game economy that is circular, that sort of loops around, then the tokenomics should work itself out. But I think, again, that's another problem that I see with games, but I suppose that's a different chat for a different day.
But very interesting comment. I actually have some difference of opinion here, but I guess like we're not like exactly disagreeing with each other. I think first of all, like in-game economy or should be just the tokenomics there. I guess like what you're saying, it's about what you're saying was about more like how you use the governance and token and whatnot. But let's use Axie as an example. I think Axie, the SLP, for example, like the problem with that is like there's not enough burn, and everyone knows that. Like if someone were to kind of redesign Axie and whatever, there are a ton of places where you can add burns of the not GST. I was thinking about step back. SLP, and then like make it fun and whatever. Like I was going to use step back as the flip example where like the GST, like you have to burn it all the time, and then that's like when you fix the shoes, and if you when you upgrade the shoes, and even like when you open the loot box, whatever. There's like a ton of places, but then because of the randomness within a game, which is the most fun part of every single game, because like people love opening the blind box or whatever. It's just like human nature. Like it makes the burn of the earning like a lot more fun. So I feel like the in-game economy at the end still is about the tokenomics, because if you were talking about like the spending, like whatever thing that's being spent in the game, it is the spending token versus, I guess, like, yes, if it's governance token, that's a different story. So I guess like that was a nuance that I was going to comment it on. The other thing I was going to kind of respond to what you're saying about the like it can't be what were you saying? It can be fun, but then or it can either be fun or either something that you play
profitable.
I think it also depends, because I think for people who pay first to play, like basically you have to buy an NFT to play, right? That's like what the Axie Infinity is, that's what Step N is, whatever. Mm-hmm. That's something you definitely, I guess, care about the profitability that more at the beginning than the fun part. But I think for any of that kind of game, like, it allows the game to start very fast and then iterate very fast, because in the traditional studio model, you'll have to raise money from somewhere, mm-hmm. or just get the capital from somewhere, and then you have a very long cycle of, like, iterating, and then, like, you probably spend 7 years before going into the public, and then all of a sudden there are some bugs, and then that just go GG. Like, that's a very problematic approach.
Yeah.
I think you know which game I was talking about. Maybe you don't, but because in the Nintendo one. But I think the key thing about, like, this whole thing is that I think while you could get money initially from either the NFT sales or some sort of, like, initial liquidity bootstrapping approach, I think it is important to have the game to be launched at the same time. Without a gameplay, buying the NFT, it's just kind of nuts. I do agree with you on that. But I think at the same time, like, you know, making a game fun to play, earning is part of the like, addictiveness. Like, today, every day these days, I go out to run because of the amount of money I can earn for Step N. But later on, I realized that all of those money I earned, I went back and burned from the upgrading, from, like, opening the loot box, or from opening the box, like, a lot of those stuff.
Repairing your shoes, repairing your sneakers.
Yeah, all of those.
Yeah.
So I realized that I actually don't earn that much, but I gained some sort of externality, which is health, which is, there are a lot of people talking about, like, oh, they lost weight and whatever because of that.
Yeah.
So I think at the end, it's about if you can earn additional profitability, at least there's some sort of positive externality from the incentivized activity that you are doing, which you used don't do.
Mm. Step N is a great example, right? I mean, like, when they so there are a lot of outlets that they can sort of that players can actually deploy their earnings, their GSD to. But another example that I give is, for example, like Diablo, or D1, mm-hmm. D2, D3, where you would be in a dungeon and you'll be hacking monsters, right? So exchanging your time to kill monsters in the dungeon. And then, you know, one monster then drops, like, a piece of iron. And then another monster drops 10 pieces of gold, for example. You can take this iron, the iron mineral, and the 10 pieces of gold, you go to goldsmith, you go to the blacksmith, or you technically go to the goldsmith too, but okay, so you go to the blacksmith, and then the blacksmith creates a shield for you, for example, right? And then you can take this shield and list it on the marketplace, and then now sell it for, let's say, 100 pieces of gold. So this guy who actually spent his time to play the game, and by chance he got that piece of iron, and he got that 10 pieces of gold, he was able to forge a new item, which then sold for 100 pieces of gold. I think in a traditional game, or in a game of if a game economy was basic, the additional 90 pieces of gold would have come from the treasury, the game's treasury or the project's treasury, but in this case it just came from another player's wallet. Right, so there was no burn technically. I mean, the only gold that was burned was 10 pieces of gold, right? The initial 10 pieces of gold and a piece of iron ore. But this player then got 100 pieces of gold back. But this difference in 90 pieces of gold did not come from the treasury, it came from another player. So if the game economy was designed this way, then the token or the utility token does not become inflationary, right? Because, you know, there's just no need for the treasury to keep sending out tokens. And then you don't have to worry about burn mechanisms, right? Because games need to worry about burn mechanisms because the tokens by nature are designed to be, or the game itself are designed to make their tokens inflationary, because every time you do something will reward you, you do something will reward you, great. But what if they could build on the storyline, build on the plot, think of more items, like the way that Stepan is doing it, right? Like you, it's not only buying loot boxes and then getting sneakers, different speed, different optimal speed, not just different speed, right? And then there's jewels that, you know, you can sort of add bling to your sneakers, right? So these are things. And then eventually imagine if you could sort of like you know, there'll be a marketplace for jewels, and then these jewels will be sold, like let's say the currency is GST in as opposed to USDT, for example, which is what's happening with Pegasi. So Pegaxi definitely will be super inflationary, like Axie, and then we're just gonna be in as long as it makes sense to, and then we will not unless something changes. But I think Stepan is going absolutely the right way in how the team's thinking about the economy rather than tokenomics. I think sometimes everyone just says whenever you talk about token, they say it's tokenomics, but it's not, right? It's really, you're designing the game. Your game studio designed the game. And think of more creative ways that people can play the game. And you know, if you make the jewels a lot more attractive, for example, like, you know, if you were wearing if you had jewels, then you'll be earning faster, not more, but faster, for example. And then these jewels cannot be bought except from the marketplace, and it can only be sold it will only be sold by another player, and then now it becomes very circular. It's a closed circular economy. There is a loop that happens wherein one player, you know, create something, he puts it on a marketplace, it is sold for a higher value, but none of these extra tokens are coming out of the game's treasury. If I design a game, that's exactly how I would do it.
Yeah, you probably don't know about the gems that you collect in the Stepan thing. You actually could synthesize three similar gems together and then upgrade to the next level. But the percentage of the success is only 35%, because I just synthesized yesterday and I was like praying that it doesn't get killed. Yeah, it was really funny. You should go try. Exactly. It's all about the randomness. Like, people love random. It's at the end of the day. So we are at almost towards the end of our pod. I just wanted to ask you one last question. You mentioned this word XYZ to earn a few times. I think we also talk about it in our conversation. So looking from a larger scale, how do you see Salad Ventures serve the larger Web3 space and platform of XYZ to earn?
So this future is, as I write up my timeline to myself, it looks more like a 10 to 15 year future. So it's a really, really big project that we're building over the next decade or so. But I think fundamentally, I've said this a few times, you've said this to me the same a few times. I think the fundamentals don't change. Whether it's play to earn, X, Y, Z to earn, the fundamentals of a good work 3.0 ecosystem involves three things. It involves a labor force. In our case, it is Apollo Squad for Play to Earn. It involves the education aspect, which in our case, again, it's Salad Academy. You need to teach people how to do things. You need to teach them how to do things properly. So the education pillar is important. And lastly, the infrastructure pillar of managing people, managing work, managing processes, paying them, auditing, stuff like that. The infrastructure pillar, in our case, we've built GitOS, will apply, I believe, in any X, Y, or Z to earn vertical. Obviously, this will evolve over time, but in order for XYZ to earn to happen or to be more efficient, you need, number one, you need people. Number two, you need training. And number three, you need infrastructure and software.
Awesome. I guess the simple The simple principle always applies to everything. It was a blast chatting with you, Felix. Thank you for participating.
Yeah, it was fun. Absolutely. Yo, thanks for having me. We should do it again next time.
All right, cool. Awesome. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.